day of teaching, so if I collapse in a puddle halfway through this...
Excuse me, is that going to be on the test?
Good on the curve.
So I was trying to find some theme here to the idea of self-annihilating neighbors, violent neighbors, and so on. I had to rule out almost all the sets of images I found, either on general poor taste or on emphasizing the Canadian-American conflict. So it occurred to me belatedly, actually, a hockey game might have been a... Anyway, this is my bit of Canadian content, for those who recognize it, mandated by the CRTC. This is actually one of the few, local television shows with an American-sized budget, if you'll pardon the expression, about a group of people who intervene when the neighbors get too violent or produce too much in the way of energetic events. So, okay. So here again, I'm sure you've... Oh, this isn't a very... Is there... That looks a little out of focus. I don't know. Okay. Well, you'll. This is a rather blurry overview of the current situation. In that case, I'm sure you've heard lots of introductions to dark matter over the course of the day. This is just my version of, I think the things I just sort of like to emphasize are that are how many different complementary probes we have, or bits of indirect or direct evidence we have for the existence of dark matter. Different scales and different redshifts, and in particular, some of them, of course, get talked about a lot, like rotation curves or even lensing. Some of them get talked about less. So, in particular, the fact that the matter density is much, much bigger than the baryon density, just from the behavior of the microwave background, and that depending on which data sets you combine, is something like a 10 to 20 sigma discrepancy between those two. So if you wanted to make all matter baryonic, then you'd have to find some solution to this problem. Or you could maybe call this, 20 sigma evidence for dark matter. Just sort of more of the same thing, that the height, the relative heights of these two peaks tell you that there's a lot more matter in the universe than the matter that interacts in a conventional way with photons, at least at the time of the microwave background. So of course there are different ways of Hazel just came online, by the way. There are different ways of looking for this direct or indirect detection. So I'll talk about indirect detection, where you look for the various things that dark matter could produce, for instance, by interacting with itself. In the case of neutralinos. So it could produce quarks or leptons or bosons or photons directly, and those in turn would give you showers of particles. In particular, if you look at the photon spectrum they produce, that goes sort of often via the route of producing pions, so you get a bump of pions at some energy that tells you something about the Wnt mass, and then you also get a cutoff at high energy, because you don't produce any photons above the Wnt mass. So both those things are nice because they then look very different from what you'd expect to see from conventional sources being sort of stochastic acceleration mechanisms that give energy to, say, cosmic rays, and then have them run into the ISM and produce photons that way. So this was... slide stolen, slightly modified from Jesus, just showing the different things that can happen. So you can get, you can produce, say, pions and have them decay. You can have photons from internal Bremsstrahlung. You can sometimes, if you're lucky, produce photons directly and get a little peak right at the WIMP energy. So those are all sort of things you create directly. Photons you create directly from the dark matter, and then there's a lower energy component you can get by taking, say, CMB photons or infrared photons or starlight and scattering it up to higher an energy. And I think this is just one of his sample calculations for a particular model, so a 200 GeV WIMP going to BB bar. And this is sort of the mix of things you get. So you get a cutoff of the WIMP energy, You get a little peak here from photons being produced around the WMP energy. You get this peak of sort of in situ photon emission, but then you also get a lower energy contribution from upscattered CMB photons. So these are all things you could go looking for. Okay. So the signal you're looking for, you can think of as two pieces. Here again, I'm sure this has come up before, earlier in the day. There's a piece that just depends, the sort of emissivity piece that just depends on the physical layout of your dark matter distribution. And then there's a piece that conveniently has all the particle physics in it. And of course, when we talk about substructure enhancements and so on, we're talking about this bit up here. So the game then is to go and look for regions where rho squared, the rho squared weighting is going to give you a big signal relative to other backgrounds. And that can happen either because halos are cuspy, or it can happen because halos have substructure. Here again, this is one of Jesus's figures, just showing the smooth component you'd expect from a halo with a sort of universal density profile, and then the component you'd expect from substructure. So the substructure you can think of as being a set of lumps that all have the mean sort of cosmological density just mixed into your matter distribution. And therefore, they add dense material at all radii, so you get a much flatter distribution out here on scales of, you know, up to the virial radius of the halo you're looking at. The normalization there between those two components then depends on this issue of how far down the hierarchy the substructure goes. So, for instance, this is from a recent paper by Liang Gao, just showing from recent very high-resolution simulations, if you add up, well, first of all, you have this red smooth component, cuspy component. If you then start adding up the contribution from substructure that's resolved in the simulation, you get sort of more and more and more. As you extrapolate that, you predict that by the time you got down to, I think this is 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, you would get, say, this curve, 10 to the minus 12, you'd get that curve, and so on. So exactly how much of this looks flat depends a bit on the physics of the small-scale matter distribution. Okay. So how can we look for all this? Well, to the great joy of many people in the room, this instrument did not blow up on launch and has been working successfully for the past 2 or 3 years, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. So Fermi has this instrument, the Large Area Telescope, which has something like 8,000 or 9,000 square centimeters of collecting area, depending on the energy. Really from energies of a few hundred MeV upwards. It looks at a large chunk of the sky in one go, 2 or 3 steradians. It has some energy resolution, and then it has angular resolution, which is very strongly energy dependent. So it's better at high energies, and it goes down to about half a degree to a degree down at the lowest energies I'm going to talk about. So that's the instrument, and really the rest of this talk is going to be about the targets. You know, what should we look for with this? Obviously, we've already looked at a number of things. So I think it's fair to say one of the original ideas was this one, to look at all this stuff. This picture is getting a little old now. This is from the Aquarius simulation, but the idea is the same, that high-resolution simulations show that around the center of a halo, you would have a lot of dense substructure, hundreds of thousands of, you know, reasonable-sized subhalos. And if you put your Milky Way in here, then you might think that going and looking at one of these nearby lumps would be a sensible thing to do. How would you find those? Well, first of all, I should say, That's a nice problem, partly theoretically, because what those lumps look like is well understood. This is really getting old now, this reference, but I think this is picture has stayed the same, that given a sort of universalish density profile from an original halo falling into a larger system, that object will get stripped roughly from the outside in. So the inner part of the density profile won't change much in shape. It may change a little in normalization, and therefore, roughly speaking, you can think of just doing a calculation on an NFW or an iNASTO profile cut off at some radius, and that'll tell you how much flux you expect to get from one of these little things. Okay. And then, of course, we know observationally that there are little things around us that have evidence for deep potential wells. So here are here's a recent attempt to model these by Luis Jagari, showing the velocity dispersion as a function of radius in a number of dwarf satellites in the Milky Way. In each case, you get velocity dispersions between about 5 and 10 kilometers a second, pretty flat profiles. And if you do some analysis on that, roughly speaking, you reproduce this older result, that the mass-to-light ratio of these objects goes up almost sort of linearly at small masses. It's almost like there's a constant mass of material in there and just a different amount of stars tracing it. And that mass is, of course, much larger. So here this is the log of the mass-to-light ratio. So here you go up to mass-to-light ratios of 100 or so compared to stellar mass-to-light ratios of about 3. So clearly there's a lot of this, you know, there's a lot of something in there generating that potential.
In tidal radius or within some fixed radius?
This is, I think, within the extent of, I'm trying to remember which one I used, actually. Matteo does two of them. I think he does one within a fixed radius and one inferred out the edge of the system. And they actually look, these points look pretty similar. These points, which are based on, galaxies, gas dynamics in larger galaxies, these move around a little bit depending on which one you do. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so running through that exercise, there's the final punchline. You can look at the dwarfs. You see no annihilation from them, and that puts a limit on the cross-section. So for different dwarfs, you get different limits. And the limits are sort of in the range here for sort of minimal supergravity models of kind of 10 to the minus 25 to 10 to the minus 24 centimeters cubed per second, which unfortunately sits right on top of the parameter space that you care about, right? So you'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that. Okay. So the question I wanted to ask was, you know, are these actually, so this was inspired by a talk a couple of months ago. Louis came and talked about this, actually, and I was left wondering, are these actually the best place to look for this signal? And then I realized that if I checked AstroPH, well, I'm not sure when the paper actually came out, it turns out I would have got the answer, which is no, they're not the best place to look for this signal. I came up with a different answer, though, so I'll talk about my answer. This recent paper by Deng Gao, for instance, pointed out if you work out the signal to noise you expect from a halo at some distance with some mass, so you get something that goes as the total flux from the system over basically its angular size. So if you work that out, the flux is going as ultimately the mass of the system, if you assume all your systems are self-similar, which they may or may not be, divided by the distance squared, and then this is going as 1 over distance, so you get a scaling that goes as mass over distance. Okay.
Sorry? Mass times density.
Yeah, so this is making a completely unwarranted assumption that everything has the same density. Okay, and that obviously won't be true if you add in, say, dependence of concentration on mass or something like that. The objects I'm talking about, it won't actually be clear what their concentration should be, maybe. So, anyway, that's certainly an issue. Okay, anyway, if you run through this calculation, it turns out that actually, whereas the local dwarfs produce a signal to noise that's sort of in this range up to, maybe 0.5% the signal to noise you would get from the Milky Way, actually, massive galaxy clusters do better. So they go from about 0.2% up to
you know, 1% or more of the signal to noise of the Milky Way. So in fact, that suggests that you know, one should go and redo that test with massive clusters. That's been done. Unfortunately, they haven't detected any emission from them, but it still gives you a limit. Another thing just to mention about the satellites is there were so many of them in that picture I showed you that there is a bit of a theoretical worry that we still don't know in detail which ones were actually sampling, right? It's a little bit worrying to be picking 10 objects out of a potential, you know, population of hundreds or maybe thousands, okay? And with some of them, we have constraints. We know they can only live within certain halos, but others we're not so sure about that. It may be one or two of them are completely unusual. Okay. Yeah.
Background. This is actually a question I would also have for the authors of those papers. Have you looked at them?
Yeah. So here you define background as some universal constant that is the same everywhere in the sky, you know, never varies, etc. Right?
Which you know is not true.
Obviously is not okay. True. So if you were going to be more realistic about this, one thing you would do is you'd then go and put in some real background model and some real uncertainty in that, which would be position dependent, right? So you'd have a galactic and an extragalactic bit. Here, I guess one way you can maybe think about this scaling is that you're assuming you can take out the galactic bit completely and that whatever you're left with is fairly uniform. So it's just scaling with the area you're doing your detection over.
But when you do that, the answer changes completely, right? I mean, there's been a large disagreement in the literature, and I've been on one side of the story saying that actually this is completely misleading because you can't exactly not do what Jennifer is referring to. You can't just subtract off the background smoothly and then get a signal to noise based on that. You just don't know what
the background is. Why can't you just subtract the background?
Because we don't know what it is. We don't have
it. But you observe it, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's all you have. So you know, all you have is what you observe.
Okay, so if you have an observation of background.
Okay. No, but in order to get the signal that's below it, which is much below the level of the galactic background, you need to subtract out something that's much larger than what you're finding, and then to get the residual. So you need to subtract out some kind of model or something. Or,
but isn't it true that the background is uniform
with
the galaxies?
No. So, and one of the reasons I think this is sort of this is more a discussion of the papers that presented this than a criticism of what you're saying, but I think this is misleading because...
It'll become a criticism of my work in a slide or two. So,
okay, I apologize.
Okay.
But, I mean, I think...
The difference is I haven't done enough work for you to really criticize that hard yet, so...
I mean, I think that it's pretty well known that identifying or detecting an extended source is much harder than detecting a point source, because if you're looking for a point source, at the very least you can define a local background and look for a delta function on top of it. If you have an extended source, which you know, for example, a massive galaxy cluster might in fact be, depending on what you assume about substructure and things like that, then it's not, you can't apply that kind of scaling at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, where the dwarf galaxy, you don't expect any extended substructure, so you can treat it very close to a point source. I'm not even saying I agree this is the best place to look either. I just said that calculation.
Okay,
really
so I guess with the dwarfs, I mean, some of them are extended on the scale of
a degree or two.
Yeah.
But the mission is very point source-like. You don't expect, for example, extended substructure in the halo to the angular distribution of the emission is still going to look very close to a delta function. It's not going to be extremely broad when you look at it. Whereas for a galaxy cluster...
I guess relative to a galaxy cluster.
You might have said it's much
fair
further.
Enough.
Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So one interesting just footnote that, you know, appears, for instance, in this paper by Gao, is the point that actually if you look at M31, M31 actually tops the list. It has way better signal to noise than any of these. And in fact, M31's been detected. So actually that's a bad thing here. It's bad that it's being detected because you're trying to get upper limits on dark matter. If you detect it, that means you're seeing something else, right? Okay. So, yeah, sorry. Like I say, it's been a long day of teaching. Okay. Okay, so what else might you detect in these things? Of course, our own galaxy is visible in gamma rays. What is that? That is, you know, a lot of it is cosmic rays interacting with the ISM. So you sort of see that it traces two things or some combination of two things. First of all, dense gas, which gives you the targets, and secondly, star formation, which gives you kind of the acceleration mechanisms. for the cosmic rays. So, as I say, if you look at M31, you know, you might expect a scaled version of this figure, scaled down to a few degrees. So I tried that, and here it is. Now, this was one of these sort of kind of cheating things. I tried this only after reading a paper by the LAT collaboration detecting M31, so I knew I would see something. I've drawn a circle around it, just so it's more obvious. I could maybe turn off the lights at the front. Anyway, it is there. You also see in this picture the non-uniform background. So this stuff is nicely traced by galactic emission. And also there are a bunch of point sources in this field. But just to convince you that M31 is really there, this circle is, I think, about 2.5 degrees. These
are, the grid is 5 degrees. 2.5 degrees in diameter. Yeah.
What was the energy range of the photons?
This was taking everything from 200 MeV upwards, 200 to 300 thousand. And it was doing, this was with the same cuts in the original paper, but, you know, now there are 3 years of data, so it's some principle. So they detected it at about 5 sigma, and you'd expect here maybe to get it at 6 sigma or something like that. Here, just to convince you that's real, I really don't know if it looks real at all. I mean, I'd have to, you kind of see something. I've also smoothed over this.
The light switch.
Oh, is there a light switch?
Yeah. It looks like a
cigarette. Put it down. You can get down.
There. Okay. Now it's definitely more complex. There. So there's the, that's the 100 micron IRAS map where you see the disk, well, the gas in M31 very nicely, right? So you see the scale of the thing. And you also, well, it's maybe not as obvious, but you can kind of see the black emission off the top, too. Okay, so that's an example where the signal-to-noise calculated from that formula was good. In fact, it was better than anything else. It was better than any of the dwarfs. It was better than any of the clusters. The problem, of course, is that here you've got emission from something else. So you would have to subtract this off, and you'd be left with some residual. So nobody would bother doing this, right? And you might think,
in general, with massive galaxies, nobody would bother looking at them as targets if they cared about emission from dark matter. In fact, it's almost the opposite. Also in this same paper, there's a very nice relation for the galaxies where there are detections in the gamma ray. There are very nice relations between, at some level, the density of gas, but in particular, the star formation rate. And the relationship with the star formation rate is particularly tight over the objects where they found they've either got detections, or here for M33, there's just an upper limit. Okay, so obviously there's a distance effect that comes in here, which is why M33 is not detected as the Magellanic clouds are. Well, distance, angular resolution, and so on. Okay, so wait a minute. So in other words, galaxies, some galaxies, local galaxies, are potentially actually good targets, except there's this annoying contribution from star formation of gas. But then, for instance, that contribution appears to scale very nicely with star formation rate. So can we find local galaxies that have very low star formation rates? Maybe those would be good targets. For instance, if we look at galaxies in, let's say, Sloan at redshift zero, and just look at the kinds of star formation rates they have. These are actually specific star formation rates, but if you convert them, you find there are things here that have large masses and low star formation rates, some cases very low, down to, say, a hundredth of a solar mass a year. And what are these things? Of course, they're early-type galaxies. Okay.
And with the mass?
It's, to my eye, it looked better. But,
okay, so you looked at both of the correlations then?
Well, I just looked at them on this figure. And my conclusion was that on this figure there was a very nice correlation here, but then MeV2 threw it off.
Is the number of hydrogen atoms that's like neutral hydrogen, or what is that?
That's the total, I think it's the total mass in neutral hydrogen. I'm not sure if they're including the molecular bit in that or not.
Why is that? But I mean,
well, so you might think if you reach some equilibrium with cosmic rays, I guess, that it's then just a matter of how many targets they have to hit. Maybe you have a
better. I'm actually not sure, so I could be totally wrong, but I thought it was the opposite. I thought it would be star formation. You tend to, for example, at supernovae and things like that going off, and you're skewing more cosmic rays into the mix. So I thought it was actually scaling the cosmic ray density, but I could be wrong.
So that was
my intuition,
so
not
that,
the target density, but the actual cosmic
right.
ray density.
So I mean, this certainly seems to scale the star formation rate well on the bottom here, right? I mean, these are the same luminosity. So yeah, this suggests it scales best with cosmic ray density, but since it is cosmic rays fading the ISM, then it kind of looks like, okay, well, it kind of also, you know, if you just knew about the ISM in the galaxy and didn't for some reason know the star formation rate, you'd get a rough estimate. Okay.
When you don't look at the halo of the galaxy, if you should just measure it.
Sure.
Later.
Sure. This is, if I go back to M31, you know, to do this, really the place you want to do it is around here, right? I mean, this is, I don't know what this is. This is maybe 30 kiloparsecs or something, this disk in size. And, if there's a theorist in the audience, you could work this out, right? What's 2.5 degrees at a distance of 28 megaparsecs? So the virial radius for this thing is huge, right? So you'd actually want to do some diffuse filter over a block. Well, depending on what you think about the substructure, right? Let's see. I think the virial radius is about 15-ish degrees at this radius, mm-hmm. which would be half the size of the circle I've plotted here.
It must fill roughly half the sky, right? Because the virial radius of the M31 and us is
practically
touched, so it's like this giant sphere out there.
And obviously that makes it much worse to find, because then you have to do a much better job of cleaning your background.
Well, M33 is inside the virial radius.
Oh, sorry. What's happening here?
But for annihilation, it's not the virial radius that matters.
Okay.
Right? if it's an NFW, it's the scale radius.
Running out of flux.
Sorry, what?
I just say, like, if it were an NFW, half the annihilation would be inside the scale radius.
Yeah, so the scale radius would then be, you know, let's say 10th, so it would be 1.5 degrees, so it would actually be, yeah, so, you know.
No,
there's some
structure.
Okay, so there's some trade-off here, obviously, how large. But let me just push ahead. So I was thinking of these objects, ellipticals. We don't have an elliptical right next door, but we have ellipticals in the neighborhood. And this, for instance, is a nice sample of them. This was, one of these rare cases where someone does exactly what you wanted to do for you ahead of time. So this was a sample of all the ellipticals you might want to look at locally. In this case, it's actually it's about a third of them, because it leaves out the southern hemisphere and the galactic plane and various other things. You probably want to leave out the galactic plane anyway. But this is something like maybe about half the sample of objects you could look at. And you can see from the pictures, well, in fact, this is only a quarter of them or something. There are 260 of them. This was a sample for everything within 42 megaparsecs that was not in the galactic plane and was visible from the northern hemisphere. And, you know, there were a few other cuts on it. But within that volume, it's complete. And there's also a cut at magnitude. So these are bright, big galaxies, right?
260 of them. Okay. So I wanted to know with these things, how bright would they be? For that, you need to know what their halo mass is. and I tried, I was thinking of ways to do this. So you can take the stellar mass and convert the luminosity and convert to a stellar mass, and then take the stellar mass and find some relation, and so on. It was getting a little bit complicated. And finally, I decided I'm just going to do the dumbest thing. I'm just going to say that the biggest galaxies live in the biggest halos, and I'll assign them one to one. This has been done before, this trick. And I'll leave out the couple of big, because, you know, within our volume there are, there's Virgo, within that distance there are other clusters and so on. So I'll leave out some top number of these. I picked 5 in the end. So I took a mass function, which has, say, about 10 objects of kind of group size or more, and then a few hundred down to about 10 to the 12 within that volume. And I match things one-to-one, and that gives me a relationship between total mass and stellar mass, which unfortunately, the axis labels are illegible on this. Here's the little bit I've cut off, but I just want to show you how beautifully this works. And this is part of the reason that axis labels are illegible. I have to make the figure very small so this works. Okay, look at this there. I've achieved one thing in this talk. It's managing to draw a jaggedy line that, as it happens, lies right on top of where the observational data is. You know, if I shift this thing over, it will sit right over the best estimates of halo masses for galaxies of a given stellar mass. So that works really, really well, and that means I can now get some reasonably good indication of what the annihilation from these things should be. I should say this is a compilation from a lensing paper by Alexi Liotto, where she worked out this issue of what's the halo mass corresponding to a given stellar mass. Her data she fit a model to it, which is this solid line, but she also plots various other determinations of that from a mixture of techniques, including lensing and satellites and all sorts of things, clustering and so on. Okay. So you can then calculate what the signal to noise would be relative to, say, M31. So here it is for different things as a function of distance. The biggest things probably get us back into the regime of clusters, so they're maybe not as interesting. But then you can see there are many, many sources that give you signal to noise somewhere between a tenth and one times what you get from M31. And the advantage is, of course, here there's much less associated star formation, maybe up to 100 times less. So it seems like if you added all this stuff together, you would gain some factor in signal to noise. And that's just a rough guess of what factor you would gain adding this stuff together. My guess is that depending on where you cut off your sample in mass, so if you don't want to look at massive systems because they'll have multiple star-forming galaxies as satellites of your early type, you could get, you know, if you put in a cut at, say, 10 to the 13, you could get 2 or 3 times the signal-to-noise you got out of M31. And if you thought you could go even higher and somehow get rid of the companion galaxies around your massive systems, then in principle you could get maybe 5 times the signal. So I've started looking a little bit at the Atlas sample, and, you know, basically the good news is I haven't found anything so far, which is the way you want this to work, right? Presumably, if I keep on looking, I will find things, because many of these galaxies have AGN in them, right? So you need to get rid of those ones. Some of them also have some star formation because they have little residual disks and things like that. But here's one, NGC 1023. Somebody's going to look it up and tell me it's a star-forming AGN. But anyway, there's nothing in the image, you know, at the center here. There are various other sources of the image, but you don't see anything. So, okay. So I've glossed over some problems here, a number of problems. So I'm returning to my violent neighbors theme. First of all, As I say, I've ignored the contribution from satellite galaxies, which by the time you're looking at systems with masses of several times 10 to the 13, those are going to be L-star galaxies. So those will be a problem. This will cut down on the area where you can do this measurement in the halo. Anyway, that's a problem. As I say, many of the ellipticals harbor AGN. That's a problem. I have, you know, assumed that there's a uniform gamma ray background and there's no problem in subtracting it off. I've totally ignored concentration. Obviously, once you get into the fact your PSF is energy dependent, that makes the problem a lot more complicated, although not necessarily any worse. But the conclusions are a happy reconciliation with the violent neighbors. You know, as I say, there's been a lot of focus on dwarf satellites, but it seems like looking at these more massive systems, you might actually do better. Okay, so I'll leave it at that. Thank you. Yeah, that's the hope. I think the only problem doing that is that blessed effective exposure calculator for Fermi. That thing takes forever. So I've got it. Okay, well, I better ask you about that because I was running that thing last night and it took like 5 hours or something. So I don't want to do that on each one. No, but yeah, the hope would be exactly to stack them, and you can think about getting more complicated, like for instance, doing some scaling to the effective radius, figuring out how much of the stellar contribution would leak out into an annulus or something like that. Yeah, so my hope would be, you know, a factor of 3 to 5 times better is not. And I didn't mention the number. You know, if you do that, the number you get in principle is, you know, it's an interesting number, I think, right? So you get a, I mean, obviously that's a model-dependent number, but, you know, just to put it kind of on the scale of the numbers I was quoting before.
And if it's dwarfs have one advantage that we know that they have high enough mass light ratios, so they probably haven't been affected by dynamic processes so much. So we don't know like how this goes for these more massive systems, but you know the dark matter distribution could be maybe enhanced by baryon by adiabatic attraction or could be reduced in the center.
Yeah. I mean I guess I was thinking of this more, you know, fairly far out in the system, like at 100 kpc. So it's hard. I think individually we have some information about this for particular systems. So we have, you know, estimates of the enclosed mass from planetary nebulae and globular clusters around some of these systems, which gives some, and there used to be a lot of controversy about that because in the center it is obviously dominated by baryon, so it's almost like, you know, it's very hard to find the evidence for dark matter. But in the outer parts, I don't know. I mean, to me, they seem pretty convincing. I think the other thing is that it depends a little bit how you feel about this plot. You know, do you believe this or not? Do you believe, you know, if you believe the halos exist, they have to be somewhere, and you would think they'd have galaxies in them, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of that argument.
Directly from lensing, you know, for the ensemble average, they definitely have halos.
Yeah, I wasn't worried that there isn't any dark matter anymore, just that the distribution of dark matter could have been affected by the Baryon.
Yeah.
But you know,
I'm not even saying that it goes like makes it worse. It can make it better.
It's true. It's true. I guess it gives you an uncertainty in what your final answer is in terms of across.
But we already know that dwarfs must be affected by baryonic processes.
Well,
because of all these problems, dwarfs, right?
Right, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the dark matter distribution was affected by that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's explanations in which that is the case, and there's others in which that's not the case.
You mean because of tidal disruption or the internal?
No, I mean that perhaps people say dwarfs are too, well, they don't have a cusp and things like that. So, I mean, the only way to explain that is by baryonic effects, isn't it? Is there any other way?
Well, there are other ways, like warm dark matter, for
example. Like the nature of dark matter.
Yeah, but there's also, I mean, you can imagine, for example, in the Milky Way, in the small mass Milky Way dwarfs, I think of all the data is consistent with them having cusps.
Okay.
So you could imagine that maybe they have large, low stimulation efficiencies, without the map actually having affected the dark matter distribution. I'm not sure that's still true for the low surface brightness dwarfs further out, but those are also more massive objects and are not necessarily so dark matter dominated.
Okay, thank you. Let's thank James again.